morning. We're going to begin. If you could take your seats, please. Thank you so much. We have a great internal affairs today, and I want to welcome you all to this IA meeting this March 7th. We have a few folks here to talk about energy storage technology, and I want to extend my appreciation for you being here. Please do not feel rushed by any means. I know we're moving fast in agenda, but it is a treat for us to have you here. I want to introduce you all to the audience here. We have with us Sharon Hillman, who's Vice President at AES. We have with us Steve McInerney. I pronounced that correctly. He's Vice President of Storage Solutions, 8-Minute Energy.
Correct.
And we have Maria Robinson, a fellow MIT graduate, by the way. She's Associate Director of Energy Policy Analysis, and she works, I believe, you're at AEE, correct? All right, and you're in Florida or Nevada?
Neither. I work in both places, but I am up in Boston, actually.
Okay. Great.
It was 11 degrees when I left my house yesterday, so it was very nice to be here.
Yes. And getting to Tallahassee is not really easy.
But worth it.
Well, it's a treat to have you all here, and this internal affairs meeting is very informal. Please just feel free to walk through the slides, or you can summarize what you want, and commissioners may interrupt you and ask questions, but it's treated very informally. With that, I will turn the floor over to you all.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you all for the opportunity to have this conversation about energy storage. We were just actually having a conversation with a few other folks in the room who said, you know, I heard a presentation on storage maybe 8 years ago, and they said it hasn't gone anywhere in 50 years. Well, the past 8 years have been busy, I will tell you, and there's been a lot of great technological as well as financial changes that have been going on, and I look forward to digging into the details with Sharon and Steve here. I'll try and keep it high level to start out as part of this. So I think we think of energy storage as being a really nascent technology, but the underlying technology has been there for quite a long time, and it's well established. There's just a lot of ongoing innovation, particularly over the last decade. And so energy storage can really be thought of in sort of three general technology categories, which is thermal, electrochemical, and mechanical. I know some people tend to think of storage as being just batteries, but there are other opportunities. And I think pumped hydro is probably the view of energy storage that's been in the common usage for the past 50 years or so. I'm thinking of some of the larger dams in use, particularly across the East Coast. And so certainly as the economies of scale have increased, we've seen the cost decrease over time. Right now, the largest battery in the world and the largest storage project is a 50-megawatt sodium-sulfur battery, which is in Japan. But soon the largest one will be in California, which will be a 100-megawatt lithium-ion battery, which has, I believe, a 4-hour duration. And that will be finished in 2018.
Are those utility scale or in large industrial users? What is that?
I'll let Sharon answer because it's her project.
Yeah, the one in California, we just christened one this week. It's 30 megawatts, 4-hour duration. That's the largest lithium-ion right now, and it is managed by San Diego. And the one being built for Southern California Edison, 100 megawatts, 4-hour duration, is also, it's a PPA agreement where we're the manage the project and for Southern California Edison.
Excellent. Absolutely. There are distributed behind the meter batteries in usage. They can be aggregated into what's called a virtual power plant or a VPP. And right now the largest is about 1,000 batteries being used together into about a 5-megawatt plant, which provides about an hour and a half of storage. And that's by SunVerge. And so I think it's important to think about the different technology benefits to the grid, particularly in terms of reliability for the folks here in the room. That one seems to have gone away. So I'll look over on this side. And when you're talking about grid scale, we're talking about integrating variable renewable energy as renewable energy makes up more and more of the generation mix in our states, we see batteries and different types of storage being used to integrate that variable technology, relieves congestion, provides voltage support. Sharon will in particular be talking about some of the flexible peaking capacity that energy storage can provide, as
Mr.
well as frequency.
Mr. Coleman has a question for you. Sorry.
Can you clarify relieve congestion? I didn't quite understand that term.
So that's to provide congestion relief on the grid, so at certain points in time you won't be able to use the transmission grid because you need more power than is available at that point in time. And so if the battery is located in an area that doesn't go, can push it out to where it's the electricity is actually needed. So if the congestion's over here and the power needs to go over here, the battery, if it is located there, would be able to provide that.
There's a category, and it's actually not the primary focus I was going to speak about today. I was going to talk more about peaking, but there's transmission and distribution alternatives. There's a lot of that going on in New York right now where, for example, it costs over $1 billion to build a substation in Manhattan. And so rather than build a new substation, you're putting batteries in the right place to put more energy out in that peak. So it's oftentimes, if you think about demand response or energy efficiency, it can be a more directly controlled form of that. It's another alternative for building new wires. And it can be done very quickly, and it's dispatchable.
And I know here in the Southeast, there are certainly plenty of concerns about land usage, and when you want to build new transmission and distribution, that has a lot of issues associated with it. So this provides an alternative use. And then behind the meter, of course, that's localized, and you can use that as sort of a small microgrid. We saw that during Hurricane Sandy and other locations where for different universities, military bases, hospitals that need power all the time, provide some ramping support and peak shaving, demand reduction, and then smooths the quality of distributed solar, which is, of course, seeing a rise here in Florida, and the quantity of that sold back to the grid. So we just made this slide, and I kind of like it. So storage has a number of different use cases, both in front and behind the meter. And this gives you a sense in terms of the capacity and size, as well as the runtime of these different technologies, as well as the different purposes that they serve. So whether if you're trying to do a bulk management system, that's great for pumped hydro, but pumped hydro doesn't do a whole lot for grid stabilization necessarily. And as you can see, there's a lot of overlap. The solid electrode batteries provide a lot of these different technologies and a bunch of these services. But that can help you better understand which technology would be right for which usage.
Can I ask you, which are in front and which are behind the meter, based on your chart?
They could be both.
Well, usually the behind the meter ones tend to be a little smaller.
Small.
So that's more on the 1 kilowatt to 100 kilowatt size. It's not necessarily less runtime. It's just a smaller capacity.
Behind the meter would be batteries. Ice storage, you could do it at the C&I level. Alleviate air conditioning loads. So, batteries nice are probably the two for behind the meter, and pump storage and molten salt are more utility scale.
So the technology that produces the longest runtime would be what?
Longest runtime is pumped hydro, just because you could have, if you have a big reservoir, and a big reservoir, obviously you could get a lot of hours, but it's
not tough
to locate it in Florida.
We're not going to see pumped hydro.
No. And it's not as flexible as batteries, for sure.
Yeah, and typically like New York State, for example, which has a lot of pumped hydro, both because of their nuclear history, which is now shrinking, but their water resource. Their pumped hydro is typically a four-hour duration, and right now most lithium-ion battery systems that are used for peaking needs are built for a four-hour duration. That's very common. These new projects that she mentioned in California are all four-hour duration projects.
So what energy storage technology do you think is most ripe for Florida? Is it the batteries?
Really most likely batteries to be here. I don't see you using flywheels, to be honest. But within batteries, that's also a very large category and a number of different technologies, whether you're talking about, solid electrode or the liquid metal batteries. There's a wide variety, and we're happy to provide more information later on the variety of batteries within that general
category. But really, the runtime for batteries is typically 4 hours?
It depends on the use. If you're using it just for ramping, you know, it might be 15 minutes, 30 minutes. Regulation in the current market state is usually about an hour duration, and for peaking needs, somewhere between 2 and 4 hours. And when you think about what you mean by duration, so say you built a 50-megawatt, 4-hour duration battery. You could also run that for 8 hours at 25 megawatts. The only thing that the battery limit has is inverter and interconnection. If it's a 50-megawatt battery, you can't run it above 50. You can go to negative 50, okay, and put grid in. But you can also run it for a longer period at a lower peak level. So it's a very dispatchable, reacts within seconds resource.
Thank you for that.
And it depends on the specific purpose that you're looking for here. I think that would...
Commissioner Pullman?
Yeah. How does the flywheel work? I mean, other than the fact that it's spinning. I understand the mechanics of it, but...
Can you say a little more about
question?
Sorry.
You know, the battery, it's a chemical type thing. You put energy in and it's stable. I mean, it bleeds off over a long period of time, but I don't understand the application of the flywheel.
I'll be happy to answer that. A couple companies have developed those. Basically, you have a big spinning mass with a DC motor generator mounted to the shaft.
Right.
So you either apply electricity to the motor and spin the mass to get it rotating when you want to charge it, or when you want to discharge it, you're using the inertia of the spinning mass to turn that generator and, again, generate electricity. So normally you're using it much the same as a battery. You're charging it up at some period of time, and then you're storing the energy and using it to then discharge later. So it's using that spinning mass to turn the generator, basically, rather than a gas turbine turning a generator. Same concept.
I guess my curiosity is, how soon before you need the electricity generated do you spin it up?
Again,
how long will it keep spinning?
They can, once you spin it up to full, they can keep it, operating at that indefinitely. You apply a small charge to it.
Right.
So spin time is similar to batteries. They're kind of geared for this 4-hour market. So you ramp it up slowly over 4 hours and discharge over 4 hours. Not a lot of companies have a commercially viable product. A lot of that's in the R&D stage. The lithium-ion battery business, which most of us are focused on, is clearly the predominant technology. Some interesting projects out of MIT and others looking at flywheels, though. Of an emerging technology.
I imagine they're fairly large.
Yeah, I mean, generally the flywheels in operation today are fairly small. They're for telecommunications devices. There is a company in California that has one about a 4-foot diameter, 1-foot thick steel mass, weighs about the same as a Ford Expedition. So they spin at 10,000 RPMs hooked up to a motor. So it's big scale stuff.
But okay.
Again, not really proven.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Maria?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be finished soon, I promise. And this is just to provide you with some sense of scale in the size of the storage market, how much it has grown over time in terms of deployment, just to give you a little bit of sense of that. And that's sort of tripled over the past 7 years here. And then on the next page, so the print is small, and I apologize for that. That always happens. The states that are in blue here have different regulatory actions going on, and so we provided that to you in case you wanted to take a look at what the different pilots are that are happening across the country. Number of them tend to be battery storage as opposed to other types of storage that they're looking at.
So why is Florida in gray?
Well, Commissioner, I think that's a little bit of a question to you and your fellow commissioners as well. I think that it's something where you could open an exploratory docket or ask some of the major utilities to move forward with a pilot. I know in Nevada they're actually...
We have approved a pilot. We have approved a storage pilot project for a different utility. And the ones in blue, do they have legislation? Are they universal pilot projects across the industry?
So California, for example, has a storage mandate. When the Songs nuclear plant was put into retirement, there were both local needs plus a realized need for peaking plus heavy solar penetration, which is creating the classic what they call duck curve, where there's actually too much power because of the amount of solar in the afternoon. So batteries are going in to absorb the power in the afternoon and then serve the customers when they come home at 5 o'clock, so 5 to 9 o'clock. So California has probably taken the lead. Another example of a leading state is New York. They have something called New York Reforming the Energy Vision, which I'm sure you've probably heard about it in the AROOP meeting or other type. And in New York right now, the current heavy emphasis is on T&D alternatives. So if a utility has a transmission or a distribution need and they come and look for capital, they have to evaluate alternative technologies as part of the process. That typically involves energy efficiency, demand response, increasingly batteries.
So is that by rule or by statute?
By rule.
By rule, okay.
Yeah, the governor started right. The initiative with Commissioner Audrey Zimmerman, who's now leaving
in Australia.
Australia, sure. Because she...
Lucky dog.
A lot of change was pushed in New York. So those are examples of very active states. And typically it tends to come either by the T&D need or the generation need because of the change of the economy from traditional generation to renewables.
Right, and I know in Nevada they've insisted that the utilities take a look at battery storage as a potential alternative for generation whenever they're proposing new generation mm-hmm. as well. And we're starting to see that sort of spread across.
Well, just to update you, we did approve a storage pilot project in the FPL docket.
And I will add that.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Excellent. And so these are just a couple technical resources if you feel like having some reading before bed. And so I will turn it over now to Sharon to talk a little bit more about the specifics on different battery technologies.
Sure.
I think
she's taking care of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here. I actually live in Florida. And
where?
Naples.
Naples.
Yeah.
In Fort Myers.
Yeah.
Naples is nicer.
No, the governor's in Naples.
Yeah, he is.
So I'm happy to be here today to talk a little bit about energy storage. I work for the AES Corporation, and I'm going to talk a little bit about who is AES. It kind of gives you an experience as to why we got into batteries. What we see as needs in Florida, just looking at statistical projections of the power market in Florida.
Yes.
And then I'll conclude with a slide about what could the commission be doing to improve the visibility of storage in Florida.
I like it.
AES is a global power company. We own two utilities in the United States, Dayton Power and Light and Indianapolis Power and Light. Indianapolis is the second most solar-intense city in the country. Not too many people know that. So we do have some direct experience there. And we got into the battery business because some very smart people in our development group started reading some college professor papers about batteries. Primarily, initially, they were looking at transportation, but they realized they could be put on the grid. And we developed our initial projects for real needs that we had at our own facilities. And for the last 4 to 5 years, we've been basically doing projects for other utilities or other large C&I customers around the globe. This is just a quick map of projects that we have in late-stage development or in conclusion. The two projects that we're talking about, which are the two largest ones, on the left-hand side, there's a 100-megawatt, 4-hour duration battery being built for Southern California Edison. And the 30-megawatt one in San Diego was just commissioned this last week. The ribbon cutting was last week. Some of you may have heard about Aliso Canyon. That's the leakage on the gas storage field. So they had an emergency in California that they needed to find peaking needs or they were going to have rolling brownouts. And
again.
So that was the solution was, there's multiple storage companies that participated in an open procurement for that. Our project was basically RFP'd and commissioned in 6 months. Now, I don't want to set expectation that 6 months is a typical for a 30-megawatt storage project. Part of the reason it was able to happen so quickly is that the state and California had studied what are the needs, and they had concluded that they really needed to have a mandate for storage. And so they were in this process of all the utilities were already putting together who are the qualified providers, what is the contract going to look like, what are potential sites. So when this happened, they were able to do it. A more typical procurement cycle for grid-scale storage would be somewhere between 9 months and 18 months. It's really just a matter of local permitting, which is it's not emissions permitting. It's more site permitting and getting the land in place.
And in California, that can be temperamental.
Yes, and that's part of the reason Southern California has air emissions. So you really cannot build a new gas peaker in Southern California. If you need to have redundancy, in certain parts of the basin, there just aren't enough emissions available to build, for example, new combined heat and power. So that's part of, in that part of California, why you're starting to see batteries.
Wow.
Part of the reason. We have a proprietary product called Advancion. We will build and operate under a long-term contract for a utility or a large customer, or we will, in essence, sell a turnkey solution. So I, for example, we sell our Advancion product to, for example, solar developers who then may want to make it part of their integrated system. We do both. We are also technology agnostic. And what does that mean? That means that if in 2 or 3 years we think there's a better solution than lithium ion, that controller technology can be used on that same control system, and we can evolve the product to that control system. So we are a technology, very consciously technology agnostic. We basically have a testing center, like our own little UL Labs out in California. It started in Indianapolis, but it's now out in California. And we run procurements from various battery providers and inverter and other equipment providers and test all the systems to meet our standards, and then we integrate the systems, either sell them as a system or sell them under a long-term contract. So this is just, we have had some awards recently being a leader in this space. So the next slide gets to what Maria was talking about. What can batteries be, or what can electric storage be used for? And there's three general categories. Generation alternative, which includes peaking needs, which I'm going to primarily focus on one or two slides today because we see that as a real need in California, or in Florida, excuse me. Mm-hmm. T&D alternatives, I talked a little bit about what's going on in New York already in response to one of the questions. And then commercial and industrial. What commercial and industrial customers are typically looking for is, one, peak shaving their wires charges, their distribution charges. If they're a peaky use, they can lower their distribution charges by, in essence, running the battery at their peak and then charging the battery in the off-peak. Those are typically behind-the-meter solutions.
So are you seeing a lot of industrial and major retailers taking advantage of these technologies?
We see some of that in terms of the larger ones behind-the-meter. For example, a Walmart-type customer would have a lot of refrigeration, so it gives them some redundancy, plus it potentially allows them to do some peak shaving to control their bill. And so those are examples of applications behind-the-meter. I'm going to slip ahead and change my order here a little bit. So when we look at Florida, we see Florida as one of the best states for storage to provide an alternative to combustion turbines, natural gas combustion turbines, for peaking in the U.S. And this is just a slide from IHS, which is an independent forecast company that forecasts needs by state. And we see a lot of need over the next 10 years for peaker growth.
The major question on this slide really is, how do the levelized costs of these technologies compare to the levelized costs of a peaker?
Okay, so I'll get to that. That's the next slide. I'll talk about that. So we see a lot of need for growth in Florida, and now I'm going to go backwards. One of the advantages of batteries over traditional combustion turbine, and we do contracting for combustion turbines too. We're not anti-combustion turbine. We are building them in Indianapolis as well as batteries in Indianapolis, is that batteries allow you to both inject and push out onto the grid, and you can do it in milliseconds, and they don't have to be standing by. They can provide black start service also. So you have a much wider range. And typically these systems are being built for 4 hours. And what's the magic about 4 hours? Typically when you study a grid, that's kind of the key period. If you can be at peak for 4 hours, there's a lot of problems that you can solve. When you look at what are the needs of the grid. That's why the New York pumped hydro tariff is a 4-hour tariff. That's kind of a good number. Typically a 2-hour duration can also greatly help with peaking needs. An independent consulting firm recently studied ERCOT, and they said 4 hours gives you 100% what you need. Yeah. 2 hours gives you about 60%. So there's variations in terms of every system is a little bit different in terms of what's the best setup. And so planning is really key. So when we talk about cost, if you look at the on the left-hand side, you have, let's just say, a four-hour battery system. On the right-hand side, you have a traditional turbine. The difference with batteries is the capital cost on an installed per kilowatt-hour basis is still higher than a typical combustion turbine. But the battery doesn't just sit idle when it's not being used. It has other benefits. So typically, if you have a four-hour battery installed, and it might be called five times a summer, and that's it. It's really only dispatched, let's say, on the most peak days, similar to, say, for example, a demand response program. However, in all of the hours that it is not providing peaking service, it can be connected to the grid and provide regulation and other ancillary services. So from the market, you get those benefits that offset the cost because you can do multiple services.
Can you elaborate on ancillary services?
So typically, for example, competitive ISOs like California or PJM or New York, they would be selling regulation, competing just with the traditional generators. And PJM, for example, recognized, we did our first pilot in PJM. We actually took a battery to their parking lot to get them comfortable with it. It sat in a container truck. I think they just finally dismantled it in the last 6 months. But it provides regulation services, and it provides it much faster and much more accurately so that it actually saves money for ratepayers because you are sending a more accurate signal. You need to use less energy, in essence, to provide that service. And PJM did a study, I think after the first 2 years or so that they were doing this, and, you know, I can't remember exactly how many millions of dollars it saved the rate payers within the footprint of PJM.
But they qualified it.
Right. And so then they put up a separate tariff that pays, in essence, a higher price per megawatt dash hour, that's how regulation is measured, than traditional frequency generator source of frequency regulation. And the FERC NOPR, for example, right now, that's part of what they're looking at is this whole issue of how should the compensation be handled for fast response resources, whether they're batteries or other technologies, versus traditional.
Thank you. All right.
And just in conclusion, you know, what can states and utilities do? What do we see as what they should be looking at? In essence, include storage as a resource when you look at your integrated resource planning. It should be considered whenever you're doing a planning model. And we'll be frank, it's an evolving capability. Most traditional planning software doesn't have a separate module for batteries, but they are starting to do that. And with some thought, you can adjust that planning. And encourage open procurement, open to energy storage, whether it's for peaking needs, transmission and distribution alternatives. Those are two things that we see as the path forward.
Thank you so much. And I will, we've just approved our 10-year site plans, and we, as I mentioned, the FPL docket, and the commission has at least expressed in those settings the interest in energy storage, which is why I thought it was very ripe to have this discussion. So we are interested. Sorry for speaking on behalf of you all, but we are.
Thank you. I had some appendix slides, so let me just flip over, get all those out of your way. If you want more information about any of those projects, they're at the back.
Thank you.
Oh, I think she has to call up your...
Okay, thanks. All right. Well, thank you, and thank you. My colleagues here went through a lot of the background information, so we don't have to go into that. I'm Steve McHenry. I'm the VP of Storage Solutions for a development company called 8 Minute Energy. We are based in California. So I apologize. I'm the only man in the room without a tie on.
I'm sure they would do it if they knew you were doing it.
Ties are still worn somewhere, so I will make sure I bring one next time. So I apologize for that. So we develop primarily solar projects, photovoltaic projects, with a storage component. We got into the business a number of years ago as a solar developer, and recently with the influx of storage and the benefits of storage, have added that to our portfolio.
Could you focus on the storage aspect?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So just real quickly, we're focused in the throughout the Southwest and the Southeast. I have a colleague here. We have operations here in Florida, Alabama, and the South, looking at developing solar projects and storage projects, both hybridized together and as standalone. One of the benefits of putting storage with a solar project is a lot of clients, a lot of utilities, a lot of commissions like the benefit of renewable power, but you want the power when you need it. Obviously, demand here is primarily in the early evening. Air conditioning load is over the course of the day. In the winter, you've got heating demand in the morning. So solar power is great, but it doesn't necessarily produce the power when the customers need it. With storage, what you can do is you can capture that energy that's generated by the sun, put it in the battery, and then deploy it when you need it. So it's that's really the benefit. You asked one of the other questions about ancillary benefits. We have a thing called non-spinning spinning reserve. So for those of you that are used to operating fossil fuel gas turbines, you obviously have an amount of power you keep in reserve, spinning reserve, so these turbines are operating at a low speed, burning fuel. With a battery, you can, in essence, turn those turbines off, use the battery as your spinning reserve, have it sitting there. If you need power, you can deploy it in 50 milliseconds. You don't have the ramp-up time of gas turbines. You don't have the wasted fuel and greenhouse gas emissions while it's sitting there idling. So,
and that technology is being utilized around the country?
It is. Southern California Edison is deploying a system, putting a 10-megawatt battery on a GE gas turbine. So the concept there is the turbine is turned off. The battery is there when it needs the call. The battery provides 15 minutes of power while they then ramp the turbine up. So you're saving all that gas that the turbine normally consumes in the non-spinning mode. So great, great application. Again, we talked about the different kinds of power. I think this is kind of interesting. If you look at the Department of Energy's energy storage website, there are 6 energy storage projects in California. I guess there will be 7 now after this pilot gets built. They're primarily lead-acid batteries and thermal storage. A lot of use of you know, generating ice at night, using that for air conditioning. What our company does, we advocate lithium-ion battery systems, both as a standalone product and as and hybridized with PV. And again, I won't waste a lot of time here on the details. Again, we kind of went through this. We will make sure that Florida is green in ours with a pilot project, so thank you. In terms of the market, why are you hearing about storage now when you didn't a few years ago? The number one driver, we can thank Elon Musk at Tesla in terms of publicity, in terms of EV vehicles, the demand from GM, Ford, BMW, Mercedes, Tesla to produce electric vehicles is really what's driven the lithium-ion battery market. The companies that produce the batteries are companies like Toshiba, Panasonic, LG, Samsung, big industrial billion-dollar conglomerates, are now producing lithium-ion batteries at half the price that they did 24 months ago. So we've had this massive cost drop in the price of
50%?
Batteries. 50%.
Wow.
And it's still got a ways to go. It's kind of like solar was 10 years ago. You had this massive cost decline. You know, there's lots of charts out there. Basically, you can see the demand for batteries in 2016, you know, was twice what it was in 14. But where is it going to be in 2020 or 2021? It's going to be 10 times what it is today. And companies like AES, they're the leader in the field, really, in deploying this technology. Companies like ours are developing projects using lithium-ion battery technology. Again, we don't make batteries. We help utilities design systems and develop projects.
Got it.
So,
what's the biggest project you all have out there?
Our storage development is relatively new for us. We have about 5 gigawatts of solar projects in development, about a gigawatt operating. We are now going back looking at adding storage to those operating assets, as well as deploying storage on the new assets.
Where are you primarily located?
Our offices are kind of across the Southwest. Nearest office to here would be Houston. We started in California and kind of worked east. So we have several projects in development in Florida currently that we're looking at and expanding that continually as time goes on.
Good.
I think that's kind of it in a nutshell. You know, we talked about storage does a lot of great things. That's kind of it.
I think it's great. Thank you guys so much for your presentation. Really encapsulates a lot of the different concepts we've talked about and gotten into the technologies. And you've got 2 engineers sitting next to me. So, commissioners, any questions on the technical aspects or anything? Commissioner Graham.
What's going on as far as the life of the battery, especially on the backside of the meter? Because, you know, years and years of having phones, you have the first year last so long. After 5 years, it lasts 5 minutes. And so what's going on as far as technology? Because I see a lot of graphs and other things, but I don't see anybody talking about life of batteries.
Right, life cycle. So typically when we design a project, we typically design it for 20 years. And our product is nodule, which means if you think of a data center with all those racks in it, that's what a battery storage facility looks like. And if a battery lasts 5 to 7, most of the batteries that historically have been in there, sort of like if they're heavily used, it's say 5 to 7 years. If it's not used every day, it's less, it's more. But what you can do is, unlike a power plant, when a battery dies, you do not have to go in and shut down the whole plant. you'd in essence shut down that node. So think about it as a data center. You pull out that rack, replace the battery pack, and put it back in. So 20-year contracting is very standard. Typically, most developers want to see at least 10 years because that's the most efficient and economic. And when we design a product, we assume certain things about what the cost will be over time when we go in and augment. It's called augmentation, the system.
But as you were saying before about the improvements, just like you're saying about the solar, because the improvements are coming so fast and furious, why do you really want to tie it up for 10 years or 20 years where, you know, the battery's going to be twice as efficient 4 years from now than it is today?
But I think you could ask the same thing about solar. If you look at solar panels 10 years ago, you know, they're more efficient than they were now, but they're products that are built for 20 or 25 years. The lithium-ion battery technology we use is the same thing. We warrant our systems for 20 years. So, I mean, you can always wait, you know, a few years and it probably gets cheaper, but you know, it's a question of when do you make that decision to move. What we've seen now is costs are competitive. We compete against an all-source RFPs. We have a project in California. We just beat natural gas on a combustion turbine basis. So we were able to offer a PPA to the client at lower than the cost of a natural gas.
It's like that flat screen TV. Did you get the plasma or did you get the LCD?
I mean, if you waited, we'd still have the big TV with the tube in it, right? But so I think the point is there's a tipping point when it becomes, you know, you make that purchase decision. I would advocate that we're kind of right there now. 2 years ago, we weren't. You know, it'll be cheaper 2 years from now. But if we can put in a solar plus storage plant and generate the power for 5 cents all in, that's pretty competitive, I think.
And I think one of the benefits of having the rack-related system is you can continually update with the newer batteries as you move along as the 5 years expire, right. 5 to 7 years.
And when we design a project, we know how much augmentation we're going to have to do based on what the project's designed to do. And we factor in what those costs are going to be at the time of augmentation. So that is getting factored into the pricing, the marketplace.
Which is a little different than your solar panel, which you're going to use the same exact one.
Right.
And not necessarily replace.
Right.
Thanks. Commissioner Pullman, any questions?
No, this is excellent. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are technology as well, looking at flywheels, interestingly enough. It's just not quite commercially there, whereas we would advocate lithium-ion batteries are a proven technology that's there.
Staff, do you have any questions for this fine group of folks? I want to thank Sharon and Steve and Maria for being here today. Thank our staff for reaching out, Casey and Mark, for getting in contact with them. It's an issue that's very important, I believe, to our country, to Florida. And so thank you for helping educate us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And we'll follow up on getting some additional materials from you all.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thanks. One last thought I meant to throw out there and breezing through the slides I completely forgot about. We talked about hurricane protection. One of the benefits of batteries with a PV system is you now have ability to create little microgrids.
Right.
So if you did have a natural disaster, you lost power, poles are broken and stuff, with PV and storage, you now have a power system that can keep going while you're restoring the grid. So another benefit you need to... I'm sorry, I had my California hat.
We hear about this at NARUC. Yes.
That's another benefit that I'm sure has some value to you.
You're sitting in a room with people who have experienced power outages quite a bit.
Thank you. That's why we got to be green, not gray. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We have one more panelist here before we get into the business, which should go pretty swiftly. Mr. David Canuck is here from Comcast Central Division. I know you guys in Leon County are pretty much all on Comcast, most likely. So I thought this would be a nice presentation. Mr. Canuck serves as Vice President of Government and Regulatory Affairs. He covers 12 states. Had an opportunity to talk with him about what he's going to talk about. Also, David used to work for the FCC. He's been a long practitioner, attorney, in this area of law, Stanford grad and Tulane. And I'm happy that you're here with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Chairman Brown. And I don't have any slides, but I do have some colorful handouts.
Yeah.
So actually, if you want to just take one.
Sure.
Pass it down.
David, we're very informal here, too.
Okay.
So I do have your report, so you could save your report.
Okay, fantastic. And I've got some for our audience members as well. So everyone can kind of take one. Thank you, Casey.
So my understanding is that you're going to talk a little bit about the Internet Essentials program for Comcast.
That is correct.
Okay.
Internet Essentials is something that we're very proud of, and it's our way of helping bridge the digital divide. So just a little bit about our company, and we are fairly ubiquitous. Every time you turn on your TV around, especially around here, you probably see a lot of what we do. But we're really more than just video, voice, and internet at this point. We also operate cable networks such as everything from Sprout, Golf Channel, one of my personal favorites, Weather Channel, USA. We also have broadcast properties, NBC, Telemundo, film studios, Universal, and also Universal Studios theme parks, Harry Potter.
Wow.
Really excellent. I encourage everyone to go down and visit that. It's amazing. So anyone who has spent more than 5 minutes talking to me in the last 6 months or so since I've been working for Comcast, you've probably heard me talk about the X1 voice remote.
I'm for you, so yeah, you guys can hear.
So one of the things that we've developed is our X1 voice remote, which you can basically press a button, you can talk into the remote, and it will turn to whatever channel that you want to go to. It's very important in a 500-plus channel universe that we have right now. It also will help you search for on-demand choices. You can put your basically say a quote from your favorite movie, and it will pull up that movie if we have it on demand. So we're very proud of that. We feel it's cutting-edge technology, and if you're a Comcast customer, you can typically upgrade to that.
Is it an actual remote controller? Is it like the OK Google, or it's kind of compatible, similar to that, where you connect it to your TV and it automatically turns it on? You don't have to even push a button?
Well, it's an actual remote, so you do have to push a microphone button. Unlike some of the other products, I think Amazon's, we're not listening to what you say in conversation. You have to press a button.
I need to get rid of that then.
Yes, so that's a selling point. So we're the voice control. We're in 13 million plus homes. More than 45% of our customers have it. We're getting 300 million voice commands per month on that system. People love it. I personally love it. We have three middle schoolers. They're crazy about it, too. Wi-Fi hotspots, we have 16 million plus Wi-Fi hotspots. For on-demand, we're getting there are 4 billion cross-platform hours viewed annually on on-demand. And we're very, we really view ourselves as a technology company. We have a large, it's a 50-story skyscraper in Philadelphia, which is our headquarters, and we're building another one right next door to it that's going to be even taller, and it's going to house basically our growing workforce of technologists, engineers, and software architects. It's going to be the eighth tallest building in the U.S., the tallest building in the U.S. outside of New York and Chicago.
You're doing a great advertisement for Comcast, but can I get you to Internet Essentials?
I just wanted to kind of bring it. Anyway, Internet Essentials. So this is a very important part of our company DNA. What is the state of high-speed Internet adoption today? Well, one in four Americans are still not connected to the Internet. So just who are we talking about? It really has to do with income. So if you look at the U.S. Census Bureau's survey from 2013, if you look at those families that are earning under $25,000 per year, 47% of them, only 47% have access to broadband internet at home. If you're looking at families from 100,000 to 150,000, it's 92%. And if you're looking at above 150,000 in annual income, 95% have access to broadband internet at home. So that's what we refer to as the digital divide. The Pew Research Center did a study on this in April of 2015, looking at access to broadband by income level for families with children. For 25, those families earning $25,000 or less, 60% have access to the internet, whereas for 150, those earning 150K or more, it's 97%.
So David, I've got a question to you really to talk about the FCC's decision on Lifeline.
Yes.
And inclusion of broadband. And just first, is Comcast interested in becoming a provider of the Lifeline here and Lifeline broadband provider?
That's something that we never actually have done as a company. So I think we're supportive of those efforts, but we're taking a kind of a wait and see approach because there have still been some changes.
Recently. I was going to say, but let's talk about the wait and see.
What, sure.
You've been involved in the industry for a few years or so.
Yes, going on 20, 25. I lost count. It's many decades at this point. Yes.
So it seems that FCC has really kind of taken a direction, and now it seems to be reversing the direction of the previous administration. Do you see that a potential repeal of the rule, the FCC broadband expansion Lifeline?
I think we have a team of people who are much smarter than I am.
No.
They have their finger on the pulse of what's going on in Washington, and so that I think they would be more qualified than I would to really answer that question. I really can't speculate on it. So I think we'll just have to take a wait and see approach.
That sounded like a good answer.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. As the role of the internet in everyday life expands at dizzying speed, those left behind face a dangerous level of isolation. And if you have school-age children, you're probably used to getting many emails per day from teachers, principals about assignments. 79% of teachers have their students access or download assignments from an online site. 76% ask students to submit their assignments online, and 50% of students have been unable to complete homework assignments because of internet access issues, and 42% of students received a lower grade on an assignment due to lack of access. So you can see this is where the rubber really hits the road. If you don't have good internet access, it's going to affect your school performance no matter how good of a student that you are.
How is that the FCC's decision to eliminate the qualifying factor of participation in the school lunch program going to affect Comcast participation in assisting consumers that need it?
That's actually a very good question. We originally, the way Internet Essentials worked is you had to have at least one student in your household who was eligible for the National Student National Student Lunch Program. So if you had that, then you were eligible. But we've broadened it since then. So, and I'll actually be addressing that a little bit later, but there are other ways that you can become eligible. So I actually hadn't really thought about how that might affect the eligibility, but we've broadened the eligibility over the years, so it's beyond just the National Student Loan Program. And I'll be kind of getting into that a little bit more as we go forward. And so I hope that answers your question.
We'll get there.
Okay. I also was very telling. More than 80% of Fortune 500 companies require online job applications. So some national chains, like Foot Locker, for instance, that you can no longer walk into a Foot Locker and apply for a job. You have to have an internet connection. You can't apply in person. But it's not just about bringing a wire to homes. It's about confronting the barriers to internet adoption. Because just because the wire passes your house, you're not necessarily going to sign up for it. There are really three issues. Relevancy: does a potential customer view it as relevant to their daily lives? Training: they might not know about how to get access to the internet. And of course, cost. So addressing these issues is no small challenge. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying. In August of 2011, Comcast started our Internet Essentials program. It was really an experiment to try to bridge the divide.
Could you summarize that, if you could, in 5 minutes or less?
Yes, okay. And I will try to be quick. But in essence, and hopefully everyone has one of these.
We do.
Excellent. So for $9.95 per month, if you qualify, if you're on the there's eligible households must have at least one child eligible for National School Lunch Program or receive HUD housing assistance. You have to live in an area that we serve, have not subscribed to Comcast for the last 90 days, and not have an outstanding debt to Comcast that is less than one year old. And if you meet those criteria, then you are eligible for $9.95 per month, internet plus tax. You can also get a computer from us, heavily discounted, for less than $150 for a nice computer.
How many people qualify, and how many people are receiving these benefits?
Well, nationally, it's about 750,000 connections. So we usually multiply that number by four. We view that as 750,000 families. So about 3 million low-income Americans. And here in Florida specifically, we have, if you go to pages 10 and 11 of our progress report, you can see some statistics on Florida specifically. But Florida, Miami is actually the third largest city with the most connections in the entire U.S., behind Houston and Chicago. So we have about 22,000 families that we're serving in Miami, and then Hialeah is seventh on the list. So Florida is definitely represented, and among all the states, Florida is second among all the states that we serve in the number of connections. So I think the key facts to me that really stand out in the progress report are that 95% of families have seen a positive impact on their children's grades as a result of participating in Internet Essentials. 98% subscribe to the service to use the Internet for home or school projects, homework or school projects. And then probably maybe my second favorite statistics, second to the 95% have seen positive impact on their child's grades, 51% of customers said that Internet Essentials actually helped them or their family member find a job. So when you can do that, you're really changing lives.
David, these are great facts, great statistics. We will absolutely keep the material that you have and look at it and continue to have a dialogue with you in the future. Appreciate you taking the time to come out here and educate us about Internet Essentials. Commissioner Pullman, do you have any questions or comments?
Well, I wanted to echo the chairman's thoughts. I did read through the material. We appreciated you providing it in advance. And a tremendous amount of work that I see in here benefiting the communities. And the fact that the state of Florida was second on the list shows a great deal of work here in our state, and I see that benefiting many of our families. Very good report, the annual report. I see a lot of work, a lot of progress here, and it's great news.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you to the company for your efforts, and I encourage you to continue that effort and reach out further.
Thank you very much, and we're always looking for partners to help us. So, to the extent people are interested in using their email lists or handing out brochures like we're doing today, that is something that we love and try to encourage.
Thank you, staff. If you have any questions, seeing none, David, thank you for taking the time to come out here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. And all right, we're going to move into the business of our IA. And with that, we will go to the legislative update, which our folks have been busy. I think, Casey, you got to be downtown soon.
Yes, this afternoon.
You've got a presentation.
I do.
coming up.
I'll let Catherine Abbey walk you through the calendar and fill you in on all the details.
I just want to say publicly, I know we've talked about it, but I want to extend my appreciation to you guys for keeping the commissioners involved and updated, and you've been very active and proactive in reaching out, and I cannot say enough fine things about your performance so far. Thank you.
Thank you. We sent yesterday the tracking report and the calendar for the week to you. We will update that calendar on a daily or two or three times a week basis as need be. I will tell you that the calendar you have in front of you just will highlight, of course, as you mentioned, Casey's presentation this afternoon in the Senate committee. And we have added to the House Energy and Utilities Subcommittee for tomorrow morning a PCB that they'll be discussing that we got late yesterday and have just started to look at.
Who will be discussing it on behalf of the commission? Is there going to be? Oh,
today? There is tomorrow? No. Okay. There's no PSC participation in the man.
All right.
So if you have any questions about any of the bills, we'll be happy to answer. I doubt you really want me to go through every single one of them.
No, we don't. Thank you. but we have been, that's why I wanted to say at the outset how much you've been keeping us informed, that we appreciate the reports, the updates, and I don't have any questions, commissioners. I know they've been keeping your offices apprised, too. If you don't have any questions, we can move along.
No, I would echo your remarks. Very helpful to work with you.
Thank you.
Good work, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good stuff. Good luck today, Casey.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Moving on to General Counsel's report. Seeing none.
No.
Thank you. Executive Director.
Only to reiterate that Consumer Protection Week is this week, and if you all haven't been checking out the Twitter account, each of our commissioners participating.
So embarrassing.
In,
it's horrible.
Video, and I don't know.
Speak for yourself.
Sorry, Mike. You haven't been out yet. Wait till yours goes out.
Every commissioner is getting a turn, so keep your eyes peeled. And I don't know if the chairman had put out the hashtag, which apparently the hashtag, we got it at hashtag by the pound, because it's the longest hashtag I've ever seen. It is pound PSC celebrates consumers NCPW.
Can you guys please like it? Please?
Again.
I have like 40 friends. That's it.
Again is
I feel terrible for you.
Pound PSC celebrates consumers NCPW.
Can you just send that to everybody in the house?
We issued a press release.
I'm glad this doesn't count against the 140 characters. that's all.
Well, and also, staff is traveling around the state this week.
They are doing outreach, as they do, incorporating NCPW, among other things. So thank you for reminding me. So,
you're welcome. Anything else?
Things that we do. No, that's it.
They do great work. This is a very important week. It's the 19th anniversary of National Consumer Protection Week, and we're very involved, and I love our PIO office. They're going to be very, very busy. Look at Laura traveling throughout the week, and Cindy, too, and thank you very much for the work that you do. With that, are there any other matters? Thank you. I have another matter. I wanted to recognize Patty Zellner, who is the Employee of the Month for March. Patty started out with the commission in 2004, I believe, as a research assistant, and then she moved to management analyst and administrative assistant in the ANG office, administrative assistant 3. She's very trusted. She is the go-to person in that department, and we're very proud of her and would like to recognize her here today for her work at the commission. Patty, you in here? Well, I'll embarrass you a little bit more later. A little bit more later. And with that, seeing no other matters, this IA is adjourned. Have a good lunch, everyone.